Okay, I'm ready.
Cool. I'm ready.
Recorded live in Petone, New Zealand and London, England, this is the Cinematica Podcast, your weekly guide to what's on at the movies. You can find this and other episodes of the show at cinematica.co.nz. Season 2, episode 24 of Cinematica. I'm Dan Slevin, reporting live from London. Joining me from the Cinematica studio are...
Kaylee.
Simon.
The two shy twins.
We're going to speak more slowly or slower because you're so far away. It takes longer to get to you.
It does. There's that echo, isn't there? That you get. It's the speed of sound. Not as fast as it used to be. No. In today's episode, Kaylee interviews the director of the Aussie smash hit The Sapphires. We also review new releases: Madagascar 3, Where Do We Go Now, and the Kiwi family film Kiwi Flyer. And we catch up with Oliver Stone's Savages. But first, let's take a look at what's in the mailbag. Kaylee, you've been monitoring progress.
Yes, we got a few tweets from Miriam, our 3D expert today. Some two-word reviews. Her review of Resident Evil Retribution is Stereo Death Trap. I'm sure the last film wasn't this wooden. Ba-dum-ching. Very nice. And Ruby Sparks, Imaginative Narcissism. I like that one.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
Thanks for that. Yeah. Better than we could do.
I should also take this opportunity to say happy birthday to Rudy Six, one of our main correspondents. But of course, this will go live the day after his birthday, but just want to let him know that we remembered.
Have a nice cup of tea and put your feet up.
Yes. And Theatre of Common gave us a little shout out, so we're going to shout out to them as well. He said, y'all should download the Cinematicacast interview with Robert and Duncan Sarkis. Don't think, just do it. Awesome.
Good work.
All right, talking about Robert and Duncan Sarkis, let's take a look at New Zealand's top five and see how two little boys did.
Yes, this week in the top five. Da-da-da. I'm going to block you out with the page. Sitting at number five, down from three, is The Expendables 2. Still hanging in there after 4 weeks. It's kind of scary. Number four, The Watch, down from two. Number three, Resident Evil Retribution, which was in the number one spot last week. Sitting at number two is Two Little Boys. And in at number one is Madagascar 3, Europe's Most Wanted.
That's interesting because there was a whole lot of tweets earlier on in the weekend saying that Two Little Boys was number one. Did it open sort of strong on the Thursday and then get sort of spanked by Madagascar on the weekend? But
not spanked, lightly tapped. Lightly tapped. Well, not spanked, but yeah. But that's because I saw a thing in the newspaper about that. I was like, really? I didn't think that was quite right. So it was. It was just over that opening couple of days that it kind of outdid Madagascar, but then the weekend, kicks in. Family time.
Sure. No, I think it's still a pretty fantastic outcome, actually, for Two Little Boys to open that strong, and I think the word of mouth will be pretty good on it.
So we don't usually do the kind of Bollywood foreign films that come through just because we have so many English releases. But if anyone out there listening has seen Barfi, can you please tell me what it's about?
Barfi.
Because it's just a golden title. It's at number 15 this week. Was it 15 last week?
Oh, B-A-R-F-I. And it's been playing all over London. Even all the multiplexes have it here.
Barfi. Can someone tweet us about that one?
Just on the subject of box office, I was keeping an eye on the US box office, and they were all hoping desperately for a sort of bounce back. All the cinemas there from a very, very low sort of US Labor Weekend box office numbers. Apparently, that bounce back hasn't happened, and the US exhibitors are complaining very bitterly that box office numbers are 29% down on this time last year.
My goodness.
So, yes, not sure whether that's still a case of big movies being held back or what have you. I mean, Looper's out now, I think. Oh, no, maybe it's not. So, yeah,
we open Looper tomorrow.
It opens in New Zealand tomorrow, doesn't it? And
it does.
But I'm not sure whether I think it might be a little bit later still for the US.
Yeah, I mean, look, I don't know. Like, you see such strong films coming, you know, later on in the year. You just can't. I mean, I'm so excited about what's coming. I mean, I can't believe that wouldn't, you know, also flow through to everyone else. So I think that it's just one of those, you know, lulls that occurs every so often.
Mm.
I mean, it's definitely due to momentum and how you maintain it, though, isn't it? You know, and how you release titles and maintain that momentum for everyone in the industry.
Exactly, and if you've got a 25 screen multiplex, that's a lot of empty seats to keep filling.
That's right.
Here in the UK, I've been to quite a few films now at multiplexes and to a couple of art houses, and. One of the interesting things this will fascinate you, Simon. I've talked to a lot of people who've said that movie tickets are really expensive here, but what they do is there's one of the big chains has a £14.95 a month membership scheme, which gives you basically free entry for the whole month.
Wow,
that's interesting, isn't it?
It is. I'm not quite sure how they divvy up box office and how the what goes back to the distributors or not, and but still, I know a lot of people who before they had kids, they were definitely buying one of those. And
would they be day and date?
You've only got to go twice, basically, to make your money back.
Would they be day and date locations?
That's one of the really big multiplexes,
right?
And not only that, if you're a subscriber to the cell phone company Orange, I think on Wednesdays you can get one extra ticket. It's like two for the price of one. So if you've got your VUE, that's VUE, if you've got your VUE membership card and somebody else is an Orange subscriber, then you both get in free on a Wednesday. So it's,
I think I know where I'm
there are ways
next.
Around it.
Wow.
I went to see Anna Karenina yesterday.
Anna Karenina, and how was it?
It's
good?
Great.
It is great.
Yeah, really
awesome.
Liked.
You see, because that's in New Zealand at the moment. Anyway, that's down for 31 January. You know, and when you look at, honestly, in the next month, in the few months ahead, it just seems to ramp up quite significantly here. And I think, I mean, it's interesting how the US kind of leads these things, and then we kind of follow with the same sort of lull, but then we also kind of lag and then sort of pick up again. You know, it's fascinating how it all kind of clicks together, but it's always got to go back up. But I mean, like, New Zealand is was tracking it not that long ago, you know, a significant amount up on 2011, so it's all swings and roundabouts. It's over the 12 months that counts.
Yeah, it is. It is too. And I wonder, I still haven't yet found anywhere on my travels movie theatres that can compare with the key Wellington locations that we know and love, places like the Lighthouse and the Embassy, places where I went to the Picture House in Stratford yesterday to see Anna Karenina, and it's an independent art house or an independent chain, if you like, and it's been open for about 14 or 15 years, and the legroom is nothing to write home about. But everything has been DCP. I haven't seen a frame of film projected basically since I left Telluride. I went to see something at the Empire Leicester Square, Savages at the Empire Leicester Square, and the screen had been hung all wrinkly. And this is like one of the major locations in the world, you know, the Empire Leicester Square, and you're looking down in the corner and you can just see all these wrinkles. It's just, you think, standards, people, standards.
Interesting that can happen.
Mm.
Not on my watch.
No. All right, time to get into the...
Speaking of savage displays.
Yes.
Yes, let's talk about savages.
Every successful business has an origin. Ben went to Berkeley and double majored in business and botany.
This is the best cannabis in the world. I think we just struck gold.
He takes 99% of the violence out of the business. The other 1%? Well, that's where Tron comes in.
You guys, you have a clean business.
But now when cartels are moving north, they want a Ben and Chan section in aisle 3.
I love you guys.
It's the 3 of us now.
And yes, I'm with both of them.
Oliver Stone's Savages, and it's... what can we say about this one? Kaylee, you have seen it, and hopefully you'll back me up a little bit on this one. This is a major disappointment from a filmmaker who has had some big highs and big lows in his career, and I'm afraid...
This is a big low.
Yeah, it is, and it's a big low on a number of levels. It's a big low because the story and the characters aren't strong enough or compelling enough to really justify your attention, but it's also a big low in that it seems kind of sloppy, you know, that for a filmmaker with his experience, you know, I said in my Capital Times review that I thought that that sloppiness must have been deliberate, because I couldn't imagine that somebody as experienced as him would take his eye off the ball to that extent. The story of the film is it's set in present day Laguna Beach, California, and there are two young men there who have a flourishing medical marijuana business, which is totally legit, except that the reason they're flourishing is they export their high-grade, top-of-the-line marijuana to all of those parts of America that don't have legal medical marijuana, so it's a completely sort of illicit, under-the-table sort of deal. And they've been living high on the hog, shall we say, these two, until the Mexican cartel turns up wanting a piece of their action, and they rather foolishly, it turns out, decide to spurn the Mexicans' offer to absorb them into their business, and they find that they're going up against the some big and brutal guys. And you know, that's quite a good setup for a story, I would imagine, and it's in an environment that we don't see very much about. But we've got two lead actors here, Taylor Kitsch and Aaron Johnson, who are possibly the least charismatic of our young sort of buff leading men. Would you agree with that, Kaylee?
I would say so. And Blake Lively, who is the woman, the damsel in distress, aptly named Ophelia, because that's super original. Blake Lively, I mean, she's pretty, but I find her acting chops measure up to Kristen Stewart. She just kind of sits there and talks, and her voiceover runs through the whole film, and she's just kind of like...
That's right. Her voiceover is, and it's endless, isn't it?
It is endless. She just yabbers on like a stoner. Which fits the film, but it's just...
Maybe it does fit the film, but also it just seems to me that it feels to me like it's one of those voiceovers that's been written after the film's been made to try and explain it.
Yeah. And, yeah, at a running time of 2 hours and 10 minutes, this whole film just feels like one bad trip. Like, it was trying to be... It's like Oliver Stone is trying to appeal to a teen audience and make this sort of, like, hardcore drug action flick for teens, and it just... Yeah, sloppy...
And it doesn't seem to end either. Like,
no. I love there's a fake ending, and that was really annoying. And then it's the real ending, and you're like, really? Did you have to like drag me through that extra 20 minutes because you thought it'd be clever? Really?
It wanted to have its cake, eat it, and then
regurgitate it, and then eat it again like a cat.
And coffee. Now, what is the story with John Travolta?
I don't know. Ever since all those stories have come out about him, he just gives me the heebie-jeebies. He's on my creeper list, so that was just weird.
But he's, you know, I actually don't think his performance is all that bad in this, but his look, he just doesn't look like a normal human being that you might sort of see walking down the street. It's like,
no.
That's a look that you could only see on a big screen, isn't it? That sort of Botoxed, leathery, smooth, face and the most amazing hair.
Yeah. I mean, there is, I think Selma Hayek puts in an interesting performance as the baddie, but even they trip up her character at the end, where she kind of is this high priestess of this Mexican cartel, and then her daughter's in trouble, and suddenly she's a simpering woman. She falls apart within 2 seconds, and that was really disappointing. But it was nice to see Selma Hayek in a role that you don't often get to see her in. But
yeah, so big disappointment. And do you have two words for us, Kaylee?
Yes, my two words is Oliver's stoned, clearly, except for this film was made and written.
Nice one. My two words for Savage is angry potheads.
How do we move through Europe without attracting attention?
Wait!
The circus.
His turn is for circus animals only.
I don't trust lion. Hair too big and glossy. He's not lion. He's lioness.
This is awkward. I fought for law and remember, we just lay low.
Just until the heat dies down.
We're invisible.
Marty?
Da-da-da-da-da-da-da, circus, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, Afro circus, Afro circus, Afro, polka-dot, Afro.
Really?
All right, they're back, the four-legged heroes of Madagascar 3, and this time they're in Europe. And Simon, I'm going to put you on the spot here because I know you saw this an awfully long time ago. It came out in the US in June, I think, and are your memories of Madagascar 3 strong enough that you can tell us all about it?
Well, look, yeah, because it's a film that really sticks with you. I seen it ages ago, but you know, obviously the distributors have had a desire to release it close to the right sort of school holidays for them, and they've held it back, but they've allowed it, you know. But we got to see it quite some time ago, and I have to say that I think that this is the most enjoyable of the lot. I really enjoyed it. The kids that I took along really enjoyed it. They had a blast. There's something in there for the adults, as there usually is with the Madagascar films, but it's just so much faster and smarter than the previous ones. So the kids had a blast. You know, the adults have a blast, and I really enjoyed it. The only sort of slight criticism I would say is, you know, it's in some places it is just the dialogue and the pace of what's happening is just so fast that you kind of miss it. You know, like it's just rocking along. You know, of course, the premise is pretty much the same. You know, they're still trying to get back to the Big Apple. They're still trying to get back to their beloved zoo, and they end up sort of the penguins take control in terms of their transport, and they end up in Europe. And there's this fantastic where they, you know, there's this fantastic that they arrive in Monte Carlo, and there's just this fantastic sort of the first like 10, 20 minutes is like an opening, you know, gambit from a Bond film. It's just bang, bang, bang. You know, it's building, 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 and it just rocks along. And you're kind of like, oh, you know, like when it actually finally settles down. So I and then their travels throughout Europe, they hook up with, you know, they're being pursued by this crazy character played by Frances McDormand called Captain Chatel Dubois. And she is evil, man. She's got all these animals strung up on her walls, you know, all these trophies and stuff, and she sees this great lion which she wants on her wall, and she hunts these guys down like relentlessly. And there's all these, you know, really smart kind of homages to other films, and there's a little bit of The Matrix in there and all these other films where she's sort of chasing them down. And so of course in there, and that, so they escape and hook up with as part of their escape, they hook up with this traveling circus. And they become part of the show, and friend, you know, there's these new characters that are introduced who are also, you know, equally as sassy and vibrant, and they all help each other to get to New York and see, you know, how life has moved on at the zoo. So it's a lot of fun. I would recommend it fully.
How long is it?
Does it feel the least, but
does
no
it feel, you know, from a kid's point of view, do you think that it'll hold them to the end?
Completely. I mean, it's about an hour and a half. It's, you know, the 90 minute sort of mark, which is perfect for those sorts of films. It doesn't go on too long. It's it's very economical. It's very taut. It just rocks along, and my kids would, you know, came out of it just buzzing, would want to see it again. I mean, I would quite happily watch it again. So I think, you know, it's going to be a nice, it'll do well over these coming school holidays, I suspect.
Right. Did you see it in 3D, Si?
Yes, I did, and I thought the 3D was really good, really good. And it was really sort of bright and colourful, and there were so many kind of action scenes, you know, where there'd be bullets flying and they'd come out, you know, like in 3D and people, you know, I mean, it was just, there was water sequences, there was all sorts of things in 3D which were really well done. It was of a high standard.
That's great. And one of the points of interest for me about this film is that it's co-written by Noah Baumbach, who may be best known in art house circles for Margot at the Wedding and The Squid and the Whale, sort of fairly heavyweight art house product, but of course also co-wrote Fantastic Mr. Fox back in 2009. So that's a pretty high quality writing team to have on a film that's got a 3 in the title.
Yeah, that's right. How often does that happen, where, you know, a sequel number 3 comes along, and in my view, it's better than the original. So I mean, it really is pretty good.
I can't wait to see it. It doesn't actually open here in the UK until after I leave, because there it's again, it's timed for school holidays, and the half term holidays here are a couple of weeks away. So
I'll book your seat.
I think it's going to be released here in the UK, going up against Hotel Transylvania, like the same week. Whereas at least in New Zealand, it's sneaking out ahead of that, so they're not going, you know, sort of it's not. Too competitive there. Do you have two words for us, Simon?
I just think, what was I going to say? I was going to say, not two words, but just better than the first. Way better. Better than the first. There you go.
Great.
Go see it. See it twice. It's really good.
See it twice. Brilliant. Kaylee, it's time for some news.
Thank you, Dan. Fantastic Fest in Austin, Texas is still going strong. Highlights include the launch of Ant Timpson's horror anthology, The ABCs of Death, and a boxing match between filmmaker Joe Swanberg and critic Dan Ferrucci, or Ferrucci, or whatever your last name is, to complete their debate about the relative merits of various remakes. That sounds great. And Ant, if you're following Ant on Facebook, he has all these fantastic like photos and things that they're posting. They're up to all these exciting events and like quiz nights and haunted houses. So, man, this should be a highlight on our Cinematica road trip next year, I think.
Oh, yes, indeed. And I'm hoping that we might be able to get an interview with Steve Austin, who's another friend of mine who's at Fantastic Fest. He'll be back next week, and so we're going to try and sort of hook him in and try and get some first-hand reports on what Fantastic Fest has been like. Another friend of mine who's there, Andrew Todd from Christchurch, won the rap competition, the onstage rapping competition, with a rap,
Andrew,
about Babe Pig in the City.
Way to go, Andrew. Congratulations.
Fantastic.
So, Fantastic Fest definitely on the agenda for next year.
Excellent. And the race for the Best Foreign Language Oscar heated up this week with confirmed entries from Denmark, which is a royal affair. Australia will be submitting Lore. Switzerland, Sister. And Germany's Barbara, to add to Austria's Amour, and frontrunner Les Intouchables from France, also known as The Intouchables, which will be opening soon here in New Zealand cinemas for us to judge for ourselves.
And what title is it getting in New Zealand? Some locations or some territories, it's getting a semi-translated title, and some are keeping the French title. And here in the UK, it's just Untouchables.
It's The Untouchables here.
Yeah, here it's the Franglish The Untouchables. Intouchables.
Mm. So. And it is, I mean, we're going to review that later, aren't we?
Yes.
So good. Loved it. Cried. Yeah,
very much looking forward to it.
It was really good. And I'm not emotional.
And that's the news for this week.
There you go.
Earlier on this week, Kaylee had the pleasure of talking to Wayne Blair, the director of The Sapphires, and it's a fascinating interview, and here it is.
Welcome to Cinematica, the favorite Kiwi cinema podcast. I'm Kaylee, and today on the show, through the magic of Skype, we have a very special guest, the directors of The Sapphires, Wayne Blair. Wayne, welcome to the show.
Hi, Kaylee. It's, yeah, Thank you.
Now, the Sapphires, of course, your not directorial debut, but this is your first feature film.
Yes, it's my first long-form film, sort of experience as an actor and writer-director in Australia for short film, TV and theatre. So, yes, it's definitely a leap.
And how, you know, speaking of leaping into it, how did you get involved with the Sapphires as a feature film? Because it started out as a stage production, correct?
Yeah, no, I was an actor involved in the original production of the Sapphires back in 2004, and it was at Melbourne Theatre Company, and then it went to Sydney at Belvoir Street Theatre. So it was a new thing for me, but you know, it was a hit musical, and then basically after it closed in Sydney, the film started to get some heat from other producers in Australia and around the world to Tony Briggs, the writer. And I was, you know, just with Tony, he's a very good friend of mine. He just sort of said to me, you know, Wayne, I think you should direct this film. And I was like, yeah, okay. But, you know, like I had no idea, you know, like the monumental task would be undertaken. I just said, yeah, Tony, like as if that will ever happen. You can put my name to a contract or a piece of paper, but, you know, like I've got other things to do at the moment, and I had another film I was going to do with my first film. So where it sits at the moment, it was just a basic promise from a friend to a friend. And, you know, of course, in the last 3 or 4 years, as the film gained momentum and I certainly had to step up to the plate. So that's how I got involved from the original writer asking me.
So the film has been doing extremely well. Started out premiering at film festivals such as Cannes, Toronto, and Telluride, where Dan, one of the co-hosts, was this year. How has the film festival experience for you guys been so far?
Oh, it's been great. I mean, we got a lovely reception in Cannes. 2,000 French people stood up and clapped. And, you know, Telluride was a beautiful experience. Well, I only went to Telluride, but I'm just telling everyone about it. So it was great. I really enjoyed it. I don't know if Dan did enjoy the location it was held at. It was for real lovers, and I'm getting to know that word cinephile, you know, people that just love cinema and respect it and, you know, forgive it and claim it as their own. So that was great. And Toronto, you know, Toronto was such a beautiful thing as well, because it was, you know, that sort of foray into the North American market, just to see how the film, I mean, the film played beautifully to the French audience and then to the North American market. It was another sort of success. But, you know, it's a very general public film, and, you know, for you to sit in the cinema when it's packed to watch this film was a good experience. So, look, I have no complaints thus far. You know, I'm going to Zurich this Thursday night, then Hamburg on the weekend, and, you know, coming back. So I'll let you know how that goes. But and then we go to the UK for a London Film Festival. But then on the 16th of October, we have opening night in Ireland, in Dublin. So I'd like to see it with a few of your countrymen, and with Chris O'Dowd there, you know. I think Chris and, you know, I expect a few Guinnesses that night. But, yeah, but it was funny. When I was in Telluride, I met up with some Irish filmmakers, a young guy called Gerard Barrett, and I saw his film, 23-year-old first-time filmmaker. Gee, it was a beautiful film. It was called Pilgrim Hill. And, God, I just hung out with Irishmen all weekend, I tell you what, and we just talked about film, and, you know, they came and saw my film, and, you know, they were there with him and another actor of the film. But there was also an Irish pastor, a preacher, and he came along for the ride. And I said, his name's Pat. I said, Pat, are you involved with the film? No, I'm just here looking after him. Like, you know, he's I'm his mother's friend, and I just thought I'd just come over. And he was like a wealth of knowledge, but, you know, a rascal as well. Like, wasn't as all, you know, strawberries and cream. He was still, you know, he'd have goes at me, and he was the funniest guy in the bloody Telluride. So, look, it's been an experience.
And of course, speaking of Chris O'Dowd, who many of us know from Bridesmaids, the big blockbuster, and also the IT Crowd, how did he get involved in the project? Because he's a real scene stealer in this film. I mean, you have this incredible female cast, who I'll also ask you about in a minute, but how did you guys get Chris on board, and what kind of drew you to him being in the movie?
Well, originally the Bat character was written as English, so we tried for a couple of English actors who said no. And then there was, you know, we're about 4 or 5 weeks away from shooting and we needed to get an actor on board, you know, because these other actors held onto the script for 6 months. So they flew me to LA. Bridesmaids just opened at the box office and it was huge. It was $26 million. And I went and saw his agent and I was after a couple of other people, to be in all honesty. And she just goes, oh, okay, the character sounds like this guy. Have you heard of Chris O'Dowd, this Irish actor? And I was like, oh, who's this guy? Like, just give me someone else. Give me someone with a name. Come on. And I was like, no, I looked at him. Then I saw the trailer on her computer and I was like, actually, this guy looks good. And then I went to Bridesmaids. I caught a cab straight from the agency and went and saw Bridesmaids at a normal cinema. And then I walked out just going, I was watching the film and the smile was growing on my face. And, you know, I walked out, and you know, because at that stage I became an expert at, you know, casting actors, and because I just knew it probably wouldn't happen. And we gave his agent the script. Chris got on board and he came back and said, yeah, I love this story. It needs to be better. And so we worked 24 hours, the producers and the two writers and myself. Set the script back to him and his agent. He loved it again. Needs to be better. So he worked on the script for another 24 hours, sent it back, and then he read the script. He read 30 pages in and said, I love it. I want to do it. And the producers made it happen. So, you know, and at that time, I mean, it was still a risk. And, you know, like Chris wasn't, you know, like a person that could do the figures as such. He's still, star was on the rise as it is now, but we sort of didn't care because he felt perfect for the role, and just the Irish sensibility is to add strength to that character was absolutely brilliant, and so it just worked to our favour.
Mm. And he's one of those great actors where it's impossible not to love him in a role as well. So
yeah, it was. I mean, when his initial note, I mean, the character was more nice. And so he said, Wayne, I'm a very nice guy. Can't do my Irish accent. He said, Wayne, I'm a very nice guy, and the character's too nice. So it'll just come across as schmaltzy. And you've got to make him harder and fractured and a drunk. And there was many times, there was a couple of times I said to the producers, I was just sort of over it, and I said, can we just make this dude a drunk racist or something? You know, he's too nice. And they were like, oh, no, audiences won't go for it. But you think about it, you know. Like, it took Chris O'Dowd to sort of push us over the line, and he wanted that to happen. And he's not a racist. He's more of an ignorant person, uneducated person, but very, very educated in the same breath.
And, you know, with your history in theater and TV and short film, it must have been really, or was it difficult or refreshing to be able to have that kind of cooperative, like building a story with your actors and with a whole crew rather than just kind of feeling like you're in a box by yourself?
Yeah, that was the most enjoyable part of it, I have to admit, just with a designer or the makeup person or the cinematographer, just sharing the vision. You know, it's great to share something, and when people, you know, when you share something and people take it on board and start taking ownership, I mean, it's just a good human sort of interaction, firstly. Secondly, when you're making a film, it just just works in very, very well. And you know, it was just I really enjoyed that process, being with everyone else and all on the same team. I think there's nothing like it. And you know, the product has ended up being good. So that's the icing on the cake. If the product was crap or, you know, stupid, it would be, okay, but we sort of enjoyed that. It is a bit of an arty, you know, thing. The journey was great, better than the destination. I have to admit that actually works, and it was like that for our film.
And, of course, along with Chris O'Dowd, you have the four wonderful leading ladies. And, of course, most audience will probably recognize Jessica Mailman. She is a... Sorry, Jessica Mowboy. I'll edit that.
Yeah, you're right.
Who is an Australian pop star, as far as my research has told me.
She won an Australian Idol winner.
Right, okay. That's what I thought. And Deborah Mailman, of course, who was in Rabbit Proof Fence, her very powerful performance in that. And Jessica were both in Brand New Day. What drew you to them for casting?
Well, you know, Jess was a I'm just going to sit back. A great singer, obviously, you know, and Deb's been a very good friend of mine for the last 12, 15 years. We're both from Queensland. Actually, and her mother is Maori as well. So she's Aboriginal and Maori heritage. Not that that had anything to do with it, but there's, you know.
There's a New Zealand connection. So there you go. Yeah.
Yes, totally. I just had to throw that in. But but she was a very good friend. But they had to audition with the rest of us, the young Indigenous girls, in a sense, because we wanted to unearth someone new, like The Voice or, you know, the Idols and New Zealand's Got Talent or something like that. We wanted to unearth someone new, and those girls went along in the same audition process, and, you know, it just worked out in the end. So with the other two girls, and, you know, Jess having Brand New Day up her sleeve, and she had six or seven scenes in Brand New Day. Here she had to sing, you know, 14 songs and, you know, act a little chops off. So it was a big task for her. But in the end, after the audition process we went through, seeing about 120 girls in Australia, they ended up being the best, and that sort of cream always rises to the top. And, you know, Deb also said, oh, look, I just don't want to be off the roll. I need to work at this audition, because she is in her mid-30s and the character is 26, 27, 28. But so she had to – she could have been a bit older for the role. But she came to those auditions, you know, with a youthful quality about her. And she, you know, she just must be that Maori blood, you know. She got those genes, so it makes her look younger. So, yeah, no, it played for us.
Exciting news, as far as distribution goes, that you have been picked up by the Weinsteins for US distribution, which is a pretty big deal.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it is. It's, you know, Harvey saw the film in the UK and instantly sort of fell in love with it. And now we're on their slate of films. So, you know, we'll get, you know, it's just definite US release. And now they've sold the film to the world. So, I mean, you know, to have Harvey and Bob and their team on board is great.
Mm. Which will be great, because North America seems to still be in the throes of that, being in love with the revival of the musical and kind of homegrown story. So it'll be nice to, you know, because it is a very Australian story. So, you know, kind of spreading that out to the world would be fantastic, because they were touted as the you know, the Australian answer to the Supremes in their time.
Yeah, I mean, you know, definitely. So, and I mean, just being in Telluride and Toronto in the last couple of weeks, just with the music, I mean, the genesis of the music, you know, came from Detroit, the Stax label and the Motown label, in which most of America grew up on. So it's sort of, they just love the music.
And what do you have next on your platter? I mean, aside from World Domination with the Sapphires, as you are going so far, any big projects or anything on the go that we can look forward to? Any snippets we can sneak to our audience?
Oh, no, look, I'm just sort of still reading, ciphering through some scripts and just making the big business deals happen, because, you know, it's Hollywood and nothing gets across the line until you sign that contract. When you give 5% to 3 or 8 lawyers, and, you know, 8% to 8 agents, and then you go, okay, you get your little $5 at the end of the line, and you go, okay, I want to make a film. So you can tell I haven't been jaded by it, but
not at all. Not at all.
No. Look, it's a beautiful position to be in, and the doors are opening. And, you know, I just want to make a film in the first half of next year. So I'm not too sure what that film is yet.
Excellent. Well, we definitely look forward to it. And again, The Sapphires opens on October 4th in New Zealand cinemas. Thank you so much for Skyping with me today, Wayne.
Oh, no worries, Kaylee.
Yes, and enjoy the rest of your tour with the Sapphires, and looking forward to some more great things from you.
Thank you.
That was my very first interview with a director. It was very exciting. The lovely Wayne Blair of the Sapphires. And I just want to give a big shout out to Trigger Marketing for setting that up for us, and Kylie for helping that all come into fruition. So thank you very much.
You gotta win, because if you don't win, you're a loser.
Aussies, eh? I'm putting together a team.
You gotta be kidding. The Kiwi flag?
We just have to make a bigger version.
43.7.
Yeah! That's my bike! I don't have your money. I bought wheels for my car.
Ian, I don't want you to have anything to do with that race.
But
you need to concentrate on your schoolwork. Now go do it.
Yeah, go!
And that is a little bit of audio of the brand new New Zealand family movie, Kiwi Flyer. And Kaylee, you are our Nelson Trolley Derby correspondent.
Yes, indeed. Yes, so Kiwi Flyer, as he says, a New Zealand family comedy about a young man who sets out to win the Nelson Trolley Derby to honor his father. It stars Di Henwood, of course, from 7 Days and other, you know, stand-up things like that. Tandy Wright from TVNZ's Nothing Trivial, although we don't talk about TV. And Vince Martin.
Or Shortland Street.
Oh, no, or Shortland Street. And Vince Martin, the iconic face of Beau Repairs. So that was great. So yeah, it's a fun little kids film. Very New Zealand, of course, set in Nelson, and the rival family that he's going up against is the Australian family, and so there's a lot of jabs at the Aussies and, you know, the language differences and things like that. Personally, it wasn't really for me, because it's definitely aimed at a much younger market, but for a kids film, I mean, there were kids in the audience and they sat quietly and seemed to enjoy it, so it was really good. Nice to see New Zealand content coming out for kids as well. You know, getting that appreciation for New Zealand cinema early is a good thing, I think. Simon, what did you think?
Okay, so I was just going to, can I just jump in there and say, so there were kids in at the screening that you were at, and they did watch, they weren't sort of climbing the walls by the end?
No, nope. They just sat quietly, and the director afterwards asked if they like it, and they kind of said, yeah. And that's like sort of awkward, scared kid kind of way. Don't want to talk to strangers.
Yeah. That Kiwi reserved nature.
Yeah.
Mm. No, I mean, look, it's pitched at a family audience. It's pitched at a, you know, I guess quite a young audience. You know, because all the characters are kind of exaggerated in the way that they operate in the film.
It's almost like a pantomime.
It is, isn't it? Yeah. But it has a good heart, and it has, you know, it has some funny moments. And I think, you know, for young sort of kids and early teens, they'll quite like it. And I think, you know, like, certainly older people too will probably enjoy it and enjoy taking, you know, their grandchildren. It's that sort of film, I think, that fits that mold.
And it is a feature debut by director Tony Simpson, and they are doing a little Kiwi Flyer road trip. So do check out your local cinema screening times and seeing if they are doing Q&As, because I know he's traveling around doing a lot of Q&As with screenings. So.
Yes, he's traveling all over the show, isn't he?
I don't want to jump in and be a bit of a wet blanket on this one. I know you guys, you saw it with an audience, which possibly makes a bit of a difference. But I found that it was awfully slow. Awfully slow. And you know, and kids these days, you know, they're used to the Disney Channel and stuff going, you know, just lots more happening, lots more jokes per minute. You know, kids are quite sophisticated audiences these days.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I'm glad that the kids audience that you saw got a kick out of it. And so I reserved judgment and prepared to be completely sort of completely contradicted on this one. But I watched it and it felt to me like something that kids would just be driven mad by. The other problem I have with Kiwi Flyer, it seems to me, is that is this whole anti-Australian thing and the raw big stereotypes of the Australian villains. And it seems to me that that's the kind of thing that kids have to be taught. You know, you have to be taught racism, don't you? You can't. We're not inherently racist. And I just wonder whether kids even care about underarm bowling and all of those things that that adults have as our with our Australian rivalry. So I'm not quite sure whether that was a good choice either.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think compared to the frenetic sugar rush of Madagascar, you know, it is. It's like it's a lot slower. But I think it, you know, it reminds me of Secondhand Wedding in a way. That's sort of exaggerated, sort of almost, you know, like you say, pantomime type acting, and that was kind of, you know, for locals it was very popular, and I think there's still, you know, there is room for this type of film in the market because it doesn't offend anyone. It doesn't sort of, I guess you could say, it offends some Australians, but But you know, there's no swearing, there's no violence, there's no, it's all just very sort of safe and nice and sort of stereotyped though, and it's comedy, I guess. You know, it's nothing out of the box. But
I'll tell you something else that I really did like and appreciate about it, and I'd link it back to Two Little Boys as well. Is that we've got when Kiwi Flyer opens, it means that we'll have two New Zealand feature films in cinemas that are set in small towns. You know, we've got Invercargill for Two Little Boys and Nelson for Kiwi Flyer, and I must admit that Nelson looks like a really great place to bring up kids.
Yeah, and this is a big event in Nelson. Like, it's been going for a long time, and it is quite a big event on the map. You know, not just in Nelson, but you know, people from all over the show go to compete. I mean, it's, and I think perhaps the enormity of the event isn't portrayed in the film that well. Like, it's you know, it's been going for quite a while, and you know, and in today's world where everything's so instant, it's kind of interesting to see a film which kind of steps back a bit and says, well, you know, you build it, you put it together, you race it, you know, which most kids, I would argue, you know, nowadays would struggle to build that type of thing, you know, like, so it's kind of cool to see that.
Yeah, maybe that's one of the reasons why it felt a bit old-fashioned, was because the actual race itself in our sort of modern day and age feels a little bit old-fashioned, but that's you know, that's not a bad thing, is it?
No, I don't think so. And it does. It kind of harks back to a slightly simpler time. And I did like the way that because he loses his dad in the film. I thought that you know, that's kind of a little bit teary, and sort of the way that the mum was trying to protect him and look after him and all those sorts of things. I thought it was that little part was well handled. You know, so it's it'll be a nice kind of matinee film for over the holidays.
Mm-hmm. Great. So let's go around the table. Kaylee, have you got two words for us?
My two words for Kiwi Flyer are Boxcar Battler.
Love it. Simon?
Fast and Furious.
Oh, talking of Fast and Furious, somebody was telling me that somebody here in London was telling me that they watched some scenes from the new Fast and Furious being shot here in London just a couple of weeks ago. So I'm, you know, looking forward to seeing whether they can get the London geography right when they smash their muscle cars around. Anyway, my two words for Kiwi Flyer, sadly, are kids yawn, because I did yawn quite a lot throughout. اللي نتخلعوا بس مش هالقد انه زايدينها كمان
هاو هن المعجوقين فيهم ومطحوطين هالفحطة هاو هن كأنه جايين من بلاد المجاعة
بطة اجري انا بتفصل ثلاثة من عائلتهم.
Okay, so where do we go now? That's a little indie from the coming back from the film festival. Does anybody remember a film called Caramel?
I do.
Yeah, yeah. It's made by the woman who made that, which was quite a lovely but at the same time quite pointed film about the situation in Lebanon and the the clash of cultures, and this is a very similar sort of situation, although much more of a fable, I think. So if you imagine you've got a remote village in rural Lebanon that is, because of damage to a bridge, it's basically cut off from the world, and the Christians and the Muslims live happily side by side, and they all sit together in the town square and watch the one working television set, and they respect each other's cultures and religious beliefs, and there's a little bit of sort of flirtation going on between sort of the men, the women there, and you know, it's all sort of blissfully happy, except for the fact that they're all supposed to be at each other's throats, and the women of the village are doing their level best to keep the knowledge of what's been going on in the rest of Lebanon out. Keep the headlines out, keep the newspapers out, and they make sure that they switch the television off when the news comes on, so that their hot-headed young men of the town won't feel that they have to sort of join in the intra-cultural, intra-religious rivalries. And so it's actually a really good setup for a film. It's a lovely film with quite a lot of humor in it, but with this serious sort of undercurrent. You know, again, just thinking about what I just said about the Australians, you know, you have to be taught to be racist, basically. And I think that in this you can see how the whole village, you know, if it didn't get taught, it was just good. They were all going to live happily together. The only issue that I really have with Where Do We Go Now, and it's kind of a sad criticism, because it's sort of the point of the film as well, is that it's a bit of a musical, and there are several occasions where the characters, where the plot stops and the characters start sort of singing, not to each other necessarily, but singing to themselves, and it just drops you right out of the film. And I sort of know that, you know, it's obviously a really important part of the whole package of the film, and the director Nadine Labaki, I just wish somebody had told her that it wasn't a very good idea, that the film itself was going to be strong enough to survive without it. It just is, you know, it's trucking along really nicely, and you've got these really well constructed characters, and the issues are being portrayed really well, and the drama's playing out really well, with, but also with lots of humor. And then the singing starts, and you just, it's like, oh, all right, I'm watching a film, right? And musicals, you know, I love musicals. Like the my most awaited film of the year is Les Miserables, for Pete's sake. But this, it just doesn't work, unfortunately. So, but I will say that if you can get past it, if you can get past the fact that they occasionally just stop and start singing, it's just a really, it's a really good film and a really good story, and I think that you know, people, adventurous audiences will get a big kick out of it.
Do you have two words for it, Dan?
I do. My two words for Where Do We Go Now is odd fable.
Excellent.
Very, very good.
And that, ladies and gentlemen, is our show for this week. Next week, I'll finally be back in the studio. You looking forward to having me back?
I guess we better get his chair back.
Oh, yeah.
We took it out. But, you know, that's right. You know, we were expecting you. Yep.
Brilliant. And on the show next week, we'll be reviewing the Sapphires. Very, very much looking forward to seeing it. Looper as well. The very much long-awaited sci-fi flick with Bruce Willis and Joseph Gordon-Levitt. And, of course, it's the school holiday fair, Hotel Transylvania, Diary of a Wimpy Kid, Dog Days, and also the not-so-school holiday fair, Dread 3D, which I've already seen. all that and more in next week's exciting episode of New Zealand's favourite movie podcast, Cinematica. If you've enjoyed this episode, don't forget to click subscribe. That way you won't have to be badgered by us to remember to download the show.
But we'll badger you anyway.
And if you want to give us feedback, you can do it through various channels, eh, Katie?
Yes, you can find us on Twitter with our Twitter handle at CinematicaCast, where we are always kind of hanging out and chatting with people and wishing them happy birthday. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/CinematicaPodcast, and of course, as always, on our website at www.cinematica.co.nz.
And the show is a Guns of Steel production. The theme music is 6x6 by Earl Van Dyke, and you can buy that at the iTunes store. And we're going to leave you with some more music, which I haven't chosen yet, so who knows what it'll be. I get to the end of the script and go, oh, that's right, I need to choose some music. We'll drop that in later, and I'm sure it will be perfectly appropriate for the show. That's good night from me.
Good night from me.
Good night from me. Thank you.